Chapter 2. The truth was, Michael Parker was more comfortable in the hard-backed seat of the Sikorsky UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter than he was on his three-seat couch in his living room back in Vermont. Not that he would ever dare tell that to his wife. Wind thrashed around the dark-colored aircraft as it hacked its way through the chop, the unsettled remnants of the rare winter storm fading back into the normal, unseasonably warm breeze.
"These annual training exercises happen later and later every year," shouted Sergeant Troy Horning from the seat next to him, a palm pressed to his helmet, his eyes glaring out from his young, wrinkle-free face.
"Next thing you know, it'll be Christmas,"
Mike shouted back, elevating his voice to be heard against the whipping rotors of the Blackhawk.
"If they're going to do these things in the dead of winter, least they could do is have them in Florida or California or something. Maybe even Vegas."
Horning leaned over so Mike could hear him.
"What? You don't like Ohio in December?" Mike asked back. "I hear the Lake Erie beachfront is gorgeous this time of year."
"You should take the wifey on vacation there next year," Troy said. "Be just like the Vermont farmlands back home."
"Funny guy," Mike replied. "How about your girl? She could even bring that jarhead she cheated on you with."
"Dang, Parker," Troy said, drawing his head back. "That's colder than Lake Champlain, dude."
"My bad," Mike yelled back, his voice barely audible over the chopping blades.
"I'm sorry." "You don't look very sorry."
Mike laughed and clapped Troy on the back, who smiled in spite of himself. Since he and Mike had first met, they'd been cutting each other up, and it seemed like every year they got a little more and more personal.
"I'd slap you on the back," Troy said, "but I'm afraid I'd bust your arthritic shoulder, Grandpa."
"Once this Blackhawk lands, I'll show you how old I am, kid."
The two of them laughed. Mike thought back, trying to remember if he'd ever been dispatched to a training session this late in the year before. He had to search back in his memory. He'd been with the Vermont Air National Guard for long enough that the years were all starting to bleed together. Below him, where the continental United States began to smear from the northeast into the Midwest, the trees and buildings and streets below blurring into a singular colored patch of meaningless static where one state merged with another, the landscape was cast in a pale purple hue, the sun above them barely starting its morning routine, a gorgeous pink dawn pushing through dark storm clouds to the north, clearly visible through the open side window of the helicopter. The nose of the Blackhawk tipped slightly as the wide-bellied aircraft began lowering altitude, drifting over the currents toward the scattering of buildings below. Gavin, Ohio, was along the southern perimeter of the state, leading toward the west, and while there were no local Air National Guard detachments in Gavin itself, that had been designated the training ground for this particular group. They were training for natural disaster relief, operating under the assumption that Ohio had just been devastated by an F5 tornado. And as one of the first responders, Mike had been the top man on the list of participants, even though he was a long way from Vermont. Lightning arced through the sky to their right, a loud snap of crashing thunder punctuating it like an exclamation point. Gavin wasn't a huge city, certainly not the size of Dayton, Cleveland, or Cincinnati, but it was probably within the top five in the state, and home to one of the largest localized power stations in the region. Mike had no doubt that part of their training would involve recovery from a local power grid failure, an additional challenge that was sure to add just enough complexity to the exercise to make it interesting. Mike was happy for the rising sun, because there were no lights on anywhere, and no indication that any would be returning soon, a vast curtain of blackness draped over the entire area. The weird thing was, Mike considered as his eyes scanned the vast region of Ohio they were flying over. He didn't see any lights on anywhere. It was daylight, but just barely, and on any normal morning, he should have seen house lights or street lights or any kind of lights. Nothing. Shadows of buildings, shapes, and structures, all just in various shades of dawn light. Had they gone so far into this exercise that they'd actually cut power to millions of homes? The mere thought of it seemed bizarre. "That look a little weird to you?" Mike asked, leaning over close to Troy.
"Talking about the power, right?" Troy asked. "I noticed that a few minutes ago."
He leaned further, looking out into the sky outside, watching the slowly rising sun in the distance.
"This time of day, people should be waking up, right?"
Mike nodded. Looking out through the open side door, he could see two other helicopters flying in formation, all three of them drifting downward, lowering their altitude as they drew nearer to Gavin, where this simulated exercise was taking place. They hadn't gotten many details on the specifics, and he wondered for a moment if the wide-scale power outage was part of it. It all seemed like too much of a coincidence.
"There's the station right there," Troy said,
pointing out of the open door, and Mike leaned over to look. Due west of their trajectory, he could see the massive power station, rising above thick trees, surrounded by nearby buildings and structures, fanning out like ripples in an urban pond. The state-of-the-art power station was a critical junction point of much of the United States power grid, one of the most advanced and recently constructed superstations designed for redundancy and resilience. It had been touted as the savior of the crumbling American power infrastructure, and Utilitron had put themselves on the map after proving its efficiency and money savings. It seemed like an odd place for an exercise, but Mike was always looking for an excuse to get back in the action. It had been almost a decade since his days in the field had come to an end, and although the Air National Guard filled some of that void, spending one weekend a month behind a desk wasn't the same as having the wind whipping through your hair or being on assignment behind enemy lines. Gavin, Ohio wasn't exactly enemy lines, but it got his heart pumping a lot more than milking the cows on the family farm did. He felt a light twist of guilt in his gut, thinking about the old homestead. This time of morning, hopefully Mary Beth and Glory were fast asleep, though even at 9 years old, Glory tended to get up with the sun. If they were awake, no doubt Glory was driving his wife crazy, and his wife was silently cursing his name. This training exercise, after all, was volunteer, and he had probably volunteered just a little bit too eagerly. Truth was, pararescue had run in his blood. It had been as much a part of him as his lungs and heart, and being torn apart from it had been the equivalent of losing a limb. Mary Beth understood that, or at least she told him she did, but he knew deep down that she'd prefer he was at home, especially for Glory's sake. Regret clamped like a fist around that same nugget of guilt, and he closed his eyes softly, trying to push it aside. Everything around him was fading into dull background noise, the whipping rotors, the beating wind, even Troy's voice mixed together into static.
"Place is huge," Troy said suddenly,
and Mike snapped his eyes open, looking out of the open door. The Black Hawk was banking gently right, and the superstation was clearly visible down on the ground a short distance below where they flew. It was concrete, its roof a convex dome, the structure itself a series of elaborate shapes. The main building was what looked like a huge rectangular bunker, the dome situated atop it, with several outbuildings clustered around, two of them square, three more of them rectangular. To the north, there was a series of towers, all fenced in by chain link and barbed wire. The structure looked like an urban palace of sorts, though instead of decorative ceremony celebrating kings or queens, it was hard and brutal urban slabs, as if in tribute to the blue-collar men and women who had built it and who now maintained it. Wind cut through the open door, and Mike felt a chill as he looked down at the power station once again, marveling at the sheer lack of light down below. The power was out down there, almost certainly, and when you were talking about one of the largest stations in the country, what did that really mean? There was a muffled sound, a dull and deep roar, almost like they were suddenly within a storm cloud during a particularly violent clap of thunder. Only the sound was coming from below. The entirety of the power station almost seemed to quiver, jolting as if being shaken. Then the concussive force slammed from the structure, shattering stone and concrete, blistering steel, tearing apart chain link and metal scaffolding, ripping it all asunder, rending it like tin foil. The entire structure of the power station suddenly folded in on itself, then exploded outward, huge hunks of broken concrete hurtling toward them, chased by tendrils of blinding hot flame. The telltale flicker in the ceiling light told Mary Beth all she needed to know about what was coming next. She'd lived in Vermont for most of her life, and had lived on this rural farm for the last decade plus. And if Mary Beth knew anything, it was that power outages were inevitable up here, especially during the height of winter. Outside, the wind chopped through the trees and the snow was blowing, a fierce and prolonged fury of white, the flakes thick and puffy, drifting in downward angles through the late morning sky. The snow wasn't accumulating yet, but she could tell by the volume of the flurries and the cut of the wind that this was going to be a doozy. For a brief moment, she turned toward the television set, an old cathode ray clunker attached to ornate rabbit ear antennae. But before she could even approach the ancient relic, the lights on the ceiling gave one last gasp and blinked into gray. "Mom!" a voice called from down the hall, and Mary Beth pressed her eyes closed at the sound of her daughter's baleful whining. "Power's out, Glory," Mary Beth replied, still through closed eyes. Little Glory Parker may have only been 9 years old, but she was a dynamic 9-year-old, a one-child wrecking crew who had significant issues adjusting to different routines. Mary Beth looked up at the old battery-operated clock on the wall and saw that it was indeed 7 in the morning, which meant her daughter's favorite cartoon had just been interrupted. Oh, this day was not starting out on the right foot already.
"Stupid power!"
the screaming voice came from the hallway. Glory's tiny, pink-hued room was actually the third small room down the hall, yet her voice sliced through the quiet air as if she were standing right next to her weary mother.
"Calm down, sweetie," Mary Beth replied, walking down the hall and drawing in a breath, mentally preparing herself for the countless difficult conversations about routines and being flexible to changing conditions. It was an adjustment Glory had yet to navigate in her 9 years on Earth, much to the exhaustion of her parents. To the little girl's credit, she'd come a very long way in the past few years, a long enough way that Mary Beth often forgot just how hard she'd been to handle at ages 6 and 7. For the most part, farm life had agreed with her and had played a large role in helping her grow. When it came to parental exhaustion, that was mostly focused on her mother. Glory's father, Mike, spent more time out of the house than inside it, a fact that Mary Beth had come to accept after being married to the former pararescue operative, though she had secretly hoped that after his forced resignation, he would have found a way to spend more time at home. He had, at least for a while, but his shift from the military to the Air National Guard and being a paramedic still managed to keep him absent more often than her daughter liked. It was yet another frustrating shift from the normal day-to-day that threw poor Glory for a loop. Mary Beth angled down the hall, walking the old threadbare carpet in a few swift strides, coming to her daughter's room just as she emerged. Glory was about 4 feet tall, short for her age, and smart as a whip. She often helped her mother with technical challenges throughout the house, and was a young girl who her mother could see growing up to be a technology professional someday. Not just because she was smart and a whiz with tech, but because she generally didn't get along with actual flesh and blood people, and was often happiest closed off in her room with a screen and some peace. The adjustment to only 2 hours of screen time per day had been a somewhat difficult battle, but the little girl had adjusted surprisingly quickly, soon learning to love interacting with the animals and the wilderness more than the impersonal pixels on a digital screen. Sure, she liked her screen from time to time, but she also spent plenty of time out in the farm with the animals, playing in the backyard with Bruce, their old hound dog, or any other manner of less technology-oriented activities. They'd been forced to increase their household budget for board games by about 10 times, but in the long run, it had been worth it. However, when Glory's narrow window of 2 hours of screen time per day was interrupted for some reason, that's when the trouble sometimes started. "Mom, you only let me have 2 hours, and it's not fair because now the TV doesn't work, and this shouldn't count because I can't even watch, and it's too snowy to go outside, and now I'm bored." Hey, kiddo, Mary Beth coaxed, coming into her room and placing gentle hands on her narrow shoulders. "Calm down, okay, Glory? It's all right."
"It's not all right," Glory complained. "Why does the power always go out? Why do we live on this farm?"
"You love this farm, honey," Mary Beth replied warmly, using all of her power to keep herself calm. Her first instinct was always to bark at her daughter, to try to convince her that not everything was a crisis, but she knew Glory's brain didn't work that way, and she took a deep, long breath to calm herself before continuing. "You love the cows. You love Bruce." Glory scowled, but didn't disagree, and Mary Beth knew she'd gotten through. "Hey, maybe when the snow stops, we can walk over to the Franklin's place and use their sledding hill. How does that sound?" Glory smiled thinly and nodded, her excitement clearly showing, though she was trying hard not to. Mary Beth bent over and gave the young girl a firm hug, and the soft jingling of a dog collar sounded from the hallway to her left. Bruce came tromping down the carpet, tongue hanging out and tail wagging, and Glory smiled broadly.
"Come on, Brucey," she said, pushing past her mother. "Let's go play ball."
The two of them vanished down the hall and around to the left, making their way to the playroom at the other side of the old farmhouse. Mary Beth sighed quietly, smiling in spite of her annoyance. She looked up at the darkened light on the ceiling and felt the brief chill in the air. The temperature was dropping outside, and depending on how long the power went out, she'd have to start getting ready. They had a wood stove strong enough to heat the majority of the house, and plenty of wood out in the shed behind the house, so she wasn't real worried about that. They also owned several generators, a stockpile of fuel in a separate shed, and beyond their livestock, there was the walk-in basement below, packed to the gills with canned goods and preserved foods. Bottled water was just as tightly grouped. In short, they had enough supplies to last months, if not years, so the idea of a power outage didn't necessarily frighten her. That didn't make it any less work to recover from, however. In her years living in this rural part of a rural state, she'd lost count of how many times they'd lost power, and on several of those occasions, it had been lost for days. It was something she was accustomed to. But Mike was gone, he was in a helicopter headed for Ohio, and so it fell on her and her alone to grab the wood, fill the stove, and crank up the heat. It fell on her to put fuel in the generators, kick over the circuits, and do the maintenance and ventilation checks. Lastly, it fell on her to convince her angst-ridden daughter that the power wouldn't be out forever and that she really did like Chef Boyardee ravioli, in spite of how much she tried to convince her otherwise. Outside, the wind picked up, blasting snow and calling out a thin, mournful howl. Yeah, it was going to be a long day.
"Hold on to something!"
the pilot screamed as the Black Hawk drove downward at an angle so steep, Mike thought for a moment that they might be vertical. From the opened side door, he could see one of the other Black Hawks trying to mimic their evasive maneuvers, but they had been closer to the station when it exploded, and a huge chunk of concrete dome plowed into the side of the helicopter, striking with a thundering impact, tearing the nose of the military aircraft from the body, splitting the helicopter in two, and sending hapless men and women spilling from the cockpit and the holding area, falling down through empty air amid smoldering stone and jagged slabs of broken UH-60 steel.
"We lost the second bird!"
the pilot screamed, her voice almost on the wrong side of panic.
"Bird down! I repeat, bird down!"
"Nothing we can do for them,"
Mike shouted back, hating himself for saying it the moment he did. They'd been lowering altitude, but were still a few hundred feet in the air. Anybody falling from that height was a lost cause by an order of magnitude. He saw motion out of the corner of his eye and turned just in time to see Troy spilling from his seat as the Black Hawk dipped right, losing his grip, starting to fall.
"No!"
Mike yelled and unsnapped his seatbelt, lurching forward, free from his seat, reaching out. He latched his fingers around Troy's vest and grabbed hard, the fabric tugging and pulling on the flesh of his clenched fingers. Troy flailed out with his left hand, grasping at the tip of the Black Hawk's open cargo door, blessedly holding tight. Mike had started to topple forward as well, but reached behind himself, grabbing the rigid seat back, and both of them narrowly avoided going out into open air as the UH-60 turned almost sideways in the sky, deftly avoiding whipping pieces of broken stone and brick. Smoke filled the air and the cabin of the helicopter as debris filled the sky around them, flame and fire searing the pink sky as if tearing open the fabric of dawn itself. Everything was happening at once. Even as Mike watched men and women that he'd known for almost a decade tumble down through a few hundred feet of open air to their deaths, a small chunk of broken shrapnel screamed from the blossom of fire and smoke, slamming hard into the tail of the Black Hawk, striking with a dull thud, hard enough that the helicopter lurched, its back end whipping around, the pilot desperately trying to compensate. Up above, the main rotor whined, groaning as the blades whipped, desperate to keep the massive, heavy aircraft elevated.
"We lost the tail!"
the pilot screamed as the UH-60 pitched down and forward, lurching like a roller coaster ride, its back end swerving. Mike, Troy, and the scattering of other Air National Guardsmen in the troop compartment shouted in surprise and barely muffled fear, the aircraft moving sideways and all around at the same time.
"Hold on to something!"
Mike screamed, clawing for a nearby chair, muscles straining, as if holding onto the seat would somehow keep him alive if the Black Hawk smashed into the ground. He felt as if he were in the eye of a tornado, wind and metal screaming around him, the T-700 turboshaft engines
roaring in protest of the sudden change in elevation and propulsion. One of his fellow airmen reached with a hand, trying to get a hold of something, then broke free of his spot and sprawled backwards, bursting through the open side door of the helicopter and screaming as he went out into the purple-hued sky beyond. Burning shrapnel rained up at them, tongues of orange fire and slate smoke spinning past the wide opening as the Black Hawk plunged downward at an uncontrolled speed, the vehicle twisting in midair, pilots screaming nonsensical commands from their bucket seats as their fingers danced over controls, trying anything they could to slow the descent.
"Mike, we're gonna die, aren't we?"
screamed Troy. Clutching tight to the same seat Mike was holding onto, the helicopter turning on its side like a beached whale, continuing its swift progression downward.
"They're gonna get us on the ground, buddy," Mike screamed back. "Don't worry, okay? Just hold on tight."
He was screaming so loud above the relentless din of the propellers and wind that his throat hurt, and he dared a glance over his shoulder, looking out through the opposite cargo door. He could see the ground below, charging up to meet them, and, horrifically, he realized they were coming down fast and hard and into a small residential area just south of the power station. Smoke filled the air, swarming in, kicked around into miniature tornadoes by the whipping rotors of the Black Hawk, and his eyes stung with it, his nostrils screaming with the scent of fuel and fire.
"Hold tight, Troy,"
he repeated, seeing the shingled roofs of the houses getting closer and larger by the second.
"Brace yourself."
Screaming filled the cabin and the hold, metal whining, and then the ground was there, and everything exploded into blackness.